Concurrently with this work of Owen's, another and quite independent series of developments was going on in America and Britain, which was destined to come at last into reaction with his socialistic ideas. The English law had long prohibited combinations in restraint of trade, combinations to raise prices or wages by concerted action. There had been no great hardship in these prohibitions before the agrarian and industrial changes of the 18th century let loose a great swarm of workers living from hand to mouth and competing for insufficient employment. Under these new conditions, the workers in many industries found themselves intolerably squeezed. They were played off, one against another, day by day and hour by hour. None knew what concession his fellow might not have made, and what further reduction of pay or increase of toil might not ensue. It became vitally necessary for the workers to make agreements, illegal though they were, against such underselling. At first, these agreements had to be made and sustained by secret societies, or clubs, established ostensibly for quite other purposes. Social clubs, funeral societies, and the like, served to mask the wage-protecting combination. The fact that these associations were illegal disposed them to violence. They were savage against blacklegs and rats who wouldn't join them, and still more savage with traitors. In 1824, the House of Commons recognized the desirability of relieving tension in these matters by conceding the right of workmen to form combinations for collective bargaining with the masters. This enabled trade unions to develop with a large measure of freedom. At first, very clumsy and primitive organizations, and with very restricted freedoms, the trade unions have risen gradually to be a real fourth estate in the country, a great system of bodies representing the mass of industrial workers. Arising at first in Britain and America, they have, with various national modifications and under varying legal conditions, spread to France, Germany, and all the westernized communities. Organized originally to sustain wages and restrict intolerable hours, the trade union movement was at first something altogether distinct from socialism. The trade unionist tried to make the best for himself of the existing capitalism and the existing conditions of employment. The socialist proposed to change the system. It was the imagination and generalizing power of Karl Marx which brought these two movements into relationship. He was a man with a sense of history very strong in him. He was the first to perceive that the old social classes that had endured since the beginning of civilization were in process of dissolution and regrouping. His racial Jewish commercialism made the antagonism of property and labor very plain to him, and his upbringing in Germany, where, as we've pointed out, the tendency of class to harden into caste was more evident than in any other European country, made him conceive of labor as presently becoming class-conscious and collectively antagonistic to the property-concentrating classes. In the trade union movement, which was spreading over the world, he believed he saw this development of class-conscious labor. What, he asked, would be the outcome of the class war of the capitalist and proletariat? The capitalist adventurers, he alleged, because of their inherent greed and combativeness, would gather power over capital into fewer and fewer hands, until, at last, they would concentrate all the means of production, transit, and the like, into a form seizable by the workers, whose class consciousness and solidarity would be developed pari passu by the process of organizing and concentrating industry. They would seize this capital and work it for themselves. This would be the social revolution. Then individual property and freedom would be restored, based upon the common ownership of the earth and the management by the community as a whole of the great productive services which the private capitalist had organized and concentrated. This would be the end of the capitalist system, but not the end of the system of capitalism. State capitalism would replace private owner capitalism. This marks a great stride away from the socialism of Owen. Owen, like Plato, looked to the common sense of men of any or every class to reorganize the casual and faulty political, economic, and social structure. Marx found something more in the nature of a driving force in his class hostility based on expropriation and injustice. And he wasn't simply a prophetic theorist, he was also a propagandist of the revolt of labor, the revolt of the so-called proletariat. Labor, he perceived, had a common interest against the capitalist everywhere, though under the test of the great power wars of the time, and particularly of the liberation of Italy, he showed that he failed to grasp the fact that labor everywhere has a common interest in the peace of the world. But with the social revolution in view, he did succeed in inspiring the formation of an international league of workers, the First International. The subsequent history of socialism is checkered between the British tradition of Owen and the German class feeling of Marx. What's called Fabian socialism, the exposition of socialism by the London Fabian Society, makes its appeal to reasonable men of all classes. What are called revisionists in German socialism incline in the same direction. But on the whole, it's Marx who has carried the day against Owen, and the general disposition of socialists throughout the world is to look to the organization of labor and labor only to supply the fighting forces that will disentangle the political and economic organization of human affairs from the hands of the more or less irresponsible private owners and adventurers who now control it. These are the broad features of the project which is called socialism. We'll discuss its incompleteness and inadequacies in our next section. It was perhaps inevitable that socialism should be greatly distraught and subdivided by doubts and disputes and sects and schools, their growth symptoms like the spots on a youth's face. Here we can but glance at the difference between state socialism, which would run the economic business of the country through its political government, and the newer schools of syndicalism and guild socialism, which would entrust a large measure in the government of each industry to the workers of every grade, including the directors and managers engaged in that industry. This guild socialism is really a new sort of capitalism, with a committee of workers and officials in each industry taking the place of the free private capitalists of that industry. The personnel becomes the collective capitalist. Nor can we discuss the undemocratic idea of the Russian leader Lenin that a population can't judge of socialism before it has experienced it, and that a group of socialists are therefore justified in seizing and socializing, if they can, the life of a country without at first setting up any democratic form of general government at all, for which sort of seizure he uses the Marxian phrase, a very incompetent phrase, the dictatorship of the proletariat. All Russia now is a huge experiment in that dictatorship. The proletariat is supposed to be dictating the government of Russia through committees of workmen and soldiers, the Soviets, but as a matter of fact, these Soviets have little or no real directive power. They assemble in meetings so big as to be practically mass meetings, and the utmost they can do is to give a general assent to the proceedings of the government. The Petersburg Soviet, which the writer visited in September 1920, was a mass meeting of over 3,000 people, incapable of any detailed criticism or direction of the Bolshevik government. Fifth. "We're all socialists nowadays," said Sir William Harcourt years ago, and that's loosely true today. There can be few people who fail to realize the provisional nature and the dangerous instability of our present political and economic system, and still fewer who believe, with the doctrinaire individualists, that profit-hunting, go-as-you-please, will guide mankind to any haven of prosperity and happiness. Great rearrangements are necessary, and a systematic legal subordination of personal self-seeking to the public good. So far, most reasonable men are socialists, but these are only preliminary propositions. How far has socialism and modern thought generally gone towards working out the conception of this new political and social order of which our world admittedly stands in need? We're obliged to answer that there's no clear conception of the new state towards which we vaguely struggle, that our science of human relationships is still so crude and speculative as to leave us without definite guidance upon a score of primarily important issues. In 1920, we're no more in the position to set up a scientifically conceived political system in the world than were men to set up an electric power station in 1820. They couldn't have done that then to save their lives.